Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
Well, you can laugh. It was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist. But having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm going to need it there.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down to Anfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawny man?
As we all know, the human body goes through a battery of changes in puberty. There follows 20 or 30 years of what are sometimes called the prime of one's life, before women go through the menopause, and men's bodies too change and modify with the onset of the years. One of these changes, and apologies in advance to those of you of a squeamish disposition, is the common and long understood lengthening of the testicular sac. It's just a fact. Don't come at me, Ken. It happens to the best of us. And so, just going simply on square footage, it's fair to say that 43-year-old Frank Lampard's balls have never been bigger than they are now. That's just a fact. And he needed all the bollocks he could muster as long ball Lampard and his Everton team resurrected their Premier League survival chances with a 1-0 win over Chelsea yesterday. Welcome to today's Maybank Holiday Monday show. Hello there, Ken.
I'm stunned, Ciarán. It's a stunning opener.
Was long ball Lampard just a step too far for you there? Long ball Larry?
I actually didn't even appreciate the pun until you
repeated it. Sorry, I was going for that Curb Your Enthusiasm.
I was thinking purely in football terms.
Longball.
I was thinking to myself, was Everton's approach very rude? I'm not actually sure that it was.
Longball lamps would have, I don't know, would that have made it clearer for you? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. No, I just, I need to just readjust the way that I think about the things you say. You got to say to that part, you got to say that this was a, this was a great day for Everton.
Mm. There was a lot of boot-biting bollock, Ken, to that performance, you'd have to say.
There really was. And, you know, it was like, it sort of had this kind of crazy atmosphere surrounding it, you know, sort of from before the kickoff, you know, where Chelsea are approaching the stadium through this, like, blue smoke, as though it was, like, you know, a European semi-final sort of thing, you know? Mm. And... I'm really thinking, oh my god, oh god, oh Jesus, like, if you're Chelsea, are you really here for this? I don't think so.
Are they bang at it, Ken? Are they bang up for this one, you know?
I really don't think so. They've been kind of catching up on games. They were playing Man United during the week, fairly mediocre performance there, nothing really to play for. You look at the opposition and they look like crazy men. You know, they're completely crazy. Like Seamus Coleman. Seamus Coleman's... Did you see Seamus Coleman's run up the sideline?
Yes.
And this was like... And actually was quite similar to... There had been a moment in the Liverpool-Newcastle game the previous day where in the 92nd or 93rd minute, Robertson did one of these, like, long runs down the left side. And the point about it almost seemed to be, look what I can still do.
Yes.
You know, it was like,
yeah.
Look, it's a show of strength, like a show of just brute dominance. I can still, I can still do this. You can't do this. This is, you know, and this is what Seamus Coleman was doing again to Chelsea. It was like, none of you want to do something like that. Like, look how out of breath I am now. what did I get? I got a throw in.
Throw it about 30 yards from the end line.
30 yards from the corner flank. We got the ball into touch. 30 yards from your goal line. My heart rate is 190 right now. And there isn't a single player on your team who's willing to do that for a throw in. Not a single one. And you know, and he was making his point. And this is a guy who'd already gone toe to toe with Azpilicueta, who is like the closest Coleman alike I can think of in the league. I think like the two of them are going at each other. It's like, wow, these guys are the same guy. But of course, it's
the Spider-Man meme.
It really was like these two mouthy little right backs going at each other. I don't really even understand what it was about. I think they were just both being captains. You know, they both had to. They were both captains. They both had to get involved. But unfortunately for Azpilicueta, things just got worse for him as he was the guy who boobed to hand Everton their goal. The now traditional Chelsea boob up at the back, which Thomas Tuchel has been getting angrier and angrier about. Richarlison scored the goal. Richarlison then threw a flare into the crowd, which was a strange moment. Now, I haven't seen yet an angle that shows where that flare went. All you see is Richarlison picking up a flare, which is still pumping out blue smoke, and then with the crowd sort of there in front of him, just lobbing it, maybe past the crowd. Everton put out
There is that corner of Goodison Park where you know, the two stands don't actually join up, isn't it, in that corner?
I think, you know? Yeah, is that like a, you know, it just seemed as though the expression on his face as he threw it just seemed not to be that of a man who was about to hurl a flare into a mass of people. I mean, I don't know if I can. Maybe he felt almost no emotion as he did precisely that. But like the other incident that immediately comes to mind of a player throwing a missile that had been thrown from the crowd onto the pitch, throwing it back into the crowd, was Jamie Carragher at Arsenal. Do you remember that incident where somebody? Was there a tangle with Dennis Bergkamp of some kind? And one way or another, a fan at Highbury threw a coin, which Carragher, either it hit Carragher or he saw it like being thrown, and he picked it up and threw the coin back into the crowd. But when you looked at Carragher's face, there was absolutely no doubt that he intended that coin to go straight back in among those fans, right? He was definitely aiming for the fans. Whereas at Richarlison, Everton's statement said like, we believe Richarlison was trying to throw the flare out of the ground. So, you know, I don't know if he actually got quite the angle that he would have needed to clear the whole stadium.
He could throw a kettle just straight over the roof of a pub. Was it a kettle or was it his old shoe?
I think he was throwing a shoe over the pub. But like, yeah, I mean, it was, and obviously I haven't even mentioned the main man, Jordan Pickford.
We'll get to Pickford because the atmosphere, the whole scenario at Goodison Park was extremely funny.
It was amazing, wasn't it? It was amazing.
It was unbelievable, absolutely unbelievable.
And Lampard then saying the fans were man of the match.
Yeah, people of the match, of course.
He corrected himself. He was like, you know, his A star in Latin sort of declension oriented mind couldn't stand over that. The fans were man of the match. He couldn't, so he had to change.
It's the start of a new month, a May that will feature the closing stages of the Heineken Cup, over a third of the entire GAA Championship season, and the final stages of the Premier League and the Champions League. So I actually just don't know if there'll ever be a better time to join the Second Captain's World Service, quite frankly. Just €5 a month plus VAT. No minimum contract. You can try it for a month and leave it if you don't fancy it. So we'd absolutely love to have you along. secondcaptains.com/join. is the place to go. There's a welcome on the mat for you right there. Now, to report on some sport, please, Ken. And you know what? Quite frankly, I don't think we can start anywhere else other than Jordan Pickford. You know what? The thing that really strikes me about Jordan Pickford's performance yesterday, Ken, was just how much he hated the limelight. You know, that just he was an unfortunate byproduct of his many great saves And unfortunately, that pushed him towards the forefront of some people's minds, when really what you were talking about was a team effort.
Yeah.
You know, and just this idea that you would single out one person over another, just the sort of thing that Jordan Pickford just hates, you know, that
it obviously
just burns him up inside to see that happen. So obviously, you know, he can feel a lot of pride, but I'm sure there's a lot of shame there this morning as well, that some of his teammates aren't quite getting the glory that they deserve for their part.
If only there was a way.
Yeah.
No, it was amazing stuff by Pickford, to be fair. I mean, he had, he had the piss taken out of him last week by his opposite number, who, you know, did, but Pickford, undeterred, was doing the same move in this game. The move which has now become it, where he, you know, you gather the ball and then you sort of, in an exaggerated slow way, go down on the knees and then down on the front and hold the ball for a few seconds. And he reclaimed it immediately from Alisson's mockery, and also took a few, you know, 100-second goal kicks, which were magnificent. But again, Chelsea didn't really seem to care. I mean, Tuchel made some, like, you know, token complaint about it. Token whinge from Tuchel about, like, the, you know, the time wasting. But then he sort of was like, well, what else do you expect? You know, and he didn't even really seem that angry about it. It's like, let's just get out of here. Let's just go home. And really, the only sort of drama coming out of Chelsea, you know, was a real anticlimactic moment for them in what's basically an anticlimactic Premier League season. Well, there is still time for a very dramatic climax to Chelsea season, but it would be very, very dramatic in a very bad way for them to collapse from this point and not qualify for the Champions League. It could happen. It's pretty unlikely, but
they will need to win a game at some stage.
Yeah, I mean, they
to make sure of that Champions League spot.
The big question at Chelsea is obviously now going to be the ownership. That's what we're actually going to talk a little bit later on in the podcast. We're going to talk to Jacob Steinberg just about what's happening there, because there was sort of some big news, or what sounded like big news on Friday with the entrance of a new player into that auction. But it seems as though Todd Bowley and Hans-Jörg Weiss, who was one of the very first people linked with a change of ownership at Chelsea, are going to be the people whose consortium is going to get there. So anyway, we're going to talk a bit about that kind of somewhat confused process and what, you know, how likely it is going to be finished pretty soon. So what else is going on? So the big question this weekend, I suppose, was obviously the Liverpool City situation. Liverpool having a very tough game away to Newcastle, which they ultimately made look, you know, easy enough, I think. Mm-hmm. It was one of those where it was like a sort of an arm's length almost. You know, they managed to keep Newcastle at arm's length. It's difficult to think of a Newcastle chance that wasn't offside. So there were a couple of chances. Chris Wood was through on Alisson, who saved his shot. Almiron got through in the first half and actually scored, but both of these were ultimately offside. And, you know, Eddie Howe, you know, there was a few things that surprised me a little bit about it. Like, Newcastle a couple of times had free kicks in their own half and sent everyone forward to attack the high ball, which I thought, okay, well, it's, you know, Eddie Howe has a reputation as a progressive coach, but this seemed, you know, I mean, like, lump it up to Chris Wood was also a lot of, the, you know, I'm not saying it's necessarily wrong, just saying that, you know, before we go, like, you know, garlanding Eddie Howe with, you know, accolades of being futuristic, let's remember what he actually did. Jake Humphrey obviously was making a lot of the headlines around this game with his comments before the match on BT Sport, where he said, as ever with this club, there are people standing on the sidelines ready to snipe and have a bit of a pop. Well, at the moment, the way they run the club is proving difficult for them, isn't it? So, you know, at the moment, the way they run the club is proving difficult for them. Difficult for these people who are on the sidelines, you know?
They've nothing to complain about as far as Newcastle United is concerned. And it's the club. It's not the dressing room, as he tried to He was eager to add some context in a later tweet.
Yeah, he said, "I appreciate how this clip looks." This was because everyone on Twitter was saying, "Oh my God, Jake Humphrey." He said, "Let me be absolutely clear, though."
Anyone who's saying that is not about to be clear. That's usually that. "Let me be absolutely clear" might be the most overused in politics phrase currently globally, and no one has a very hard time disbelieving anything that follows the words "Let me be absolutely clear."
So let me be absolutely clear, though. Eddie Howard left us moments before this. We were talking about him, and my praise, my use of "they," was aimed squarely and only at him and his staff. Okay, so "they," I was thinking, is Eddie Howe, "they," "them," or, you know, what's the story with his pronoun? And he's running the club. Well, you know, is he running the club, though? Or is he... I thought he was very narrowly focused on coaching and training the team.
No, I think actually Eddie Howe has been perfectly clear.
I think he's quite stipulated that quite clearly. Let Eddie Howe
be absolutely clear that he has nothing to do with the running of the club. He's and everything to do with the running of the dressing room. He is a football manager.
Within the white lines and not outside. Well, the inner sanctum of the dressing room, yes, but certainly nothing to do with the outer world. I mean, he didn't think about the outer world. You know, because he doesn't have time. He's got too much time coaching and training the players of the football tactics. I don't know. You see, it sort of echoed that Luke Edwards article, or sort of the way that it's constructed. Like, say, when Luke Edwards had written in the Telegraph about, the sports people, "You see sports washing, I see a great team coming together," you know. And it was this photograph, you know, Eddie Howe. They didn't have to do a photograph after the Liverpool game, because they lost. But if they, you know, they were in there with the owners and so on and so forth. And it starts in the first line, he's talking about, "particularly for those who struggle to see the positives in Newcastle's revival." And then, you know, later on, his presence, that's the presence of Saudi chairman Yasser Al-Rumayyan in the photograph, his presence offended those who wish to be offended by it. And then after that, Amanda Staveley and Jamie Rubin, all of which was fueled to those who were seeking reasons to be outraged. You know what I mean? And then here's Humphrey talking about, what is it he's talking about? "People standing on the sidelines ready to snipe and have a bit of a pop." Just say who you mean. Just say, like, who are you talking about? Like, and if it's just Eddie Howe that you're talking about, that you know, it wasn't the Saudi ownership, or wasn't, you know, Staveley and, you know, the Yasser Al-Rumayyan or whoever, it wasn't these people who you're talking about who run the club, the way they're running the club. Like, why are people having a snipe at Eddie Howe? Well, like, why are there always people at Newcastle standing on the sidelines waiting to have a pop at Eddie Howe? I don't know. I don't get that. I mean, it seems to me he gets quite a lot of praise. I mean, he gets enormous praise, you know, for considering his, what a job he's done. You're like, well, yeah, did he do a job, or were they the biggest spending club in the world in January? I mean, there's a combination of factors that have gone on there. But anyway, this whole theme of, oh, the people who are just looking to be outraged, you know what I mean? Just say you mean. Don't like invent a sort of a phantom kind of naysayer group.
Yeah, you're going to have to deal with the reason why people are outraged. You can't just say, "Oh, well, you know, that's people are going to be outraged." It's like, well, what are they outraged by?
Yeah,
not no, outraged it's by this, the results. Like,
because what this really is, you know, supporting NUFC to own the libs. You know what I mean? and that's what it is. Sort of hand waving executions to own the libs. So. That's the issue. Anyway, so I always look out for that whenever I see it. Oh, you know, those people who want it, blah, blah. Anyway, so what else was going to ask? Okay, so Man City then were in the situation where they were now behind, had to respond, and they're against Leeds, and Coach Marsh, who has delivered the line in his pre-match press conference, which clocked in at 30 minutes. You know, a voluble press conference from Coach Marsh, where he said, "We think it's the best team in the world against the best club in the world." And then he kind of grinned at the audience, who reacted with sort of bemused silence. And then he was like,
"There's your headline, boys."
It really is. His smile absolutely said that. You know, absolutely. It was like, you know, I've actually, don't worry, I've actually provided the headline for you. But the best team in the world, the best club in the world. The best club in the world was Leeds United. Didn't really give City much of a game here. They did go and fiercely chase the game. I mean, this was basically what Marsh was saying. You know, we're going to be pesky. We're going to be annoying. We're going to try and find moments to tip the balance. You know, it's all about the application of energy in the right way. And Leeds certainly poured on plenty of energy. It just wasn't... I mean, I think the moment when Stuart Dallas apparently has broken his femur against Jack Grealish's leg. Jack Grealish, who... Grealish was going for a ball. Dallas decided to go for the ball, even though he's not going to get it. Like, I mean, maybe he'll get it, but more likely he's just going to foul Grealish. And Grealish, to me, I think, knew that... could see Dallas coming and basically protected himself by just sort of angling his body, angling his leg, so that Dallas like ran into what effectively was a brick wall. Mm. And apparently Leeds have announced he has a fracture in his femur, which is an incredibly serious injury. When I say it's a serious injury, I mean it's I'm not suggesting it's Stuart Dallas's career is in the balance. I think he should recover from it fully, but like that's a major, you know, in terms it's of the true, impact. You don't hear about that.
Exactly. Yeah. It's indicative of something that doesn't a level of impact that doesn't usually happen on the football field.
Yeah. I think indicated Leeds' approach to the game, but ultimately there wasn't a lot of. I mean, there was an incredibly dramatic moment at 0-0 when Cancelo just fell over as though he'd been like tasered. You know, he looked like someone had tased Cancelo in the center circle. He suddenly fell down and Rodrigo was running through. Like, and you're like, my God, this is one of those things. This is one of those Gerrard type things that have happened. Mm. But maybe Demba Ba doesn't get enough credit. You know,
It was a bloody good finish.
He still had to finish it off, you know, and Rodrigo.
He had to take at least three touches of the ball before he kicked the goal, yeah.
Mignolet sort of, maybe, I'm not sure what Ederson did on this, but one way or the other, Leeds couldn't finish off. And then what happened, City started to score goals and eventually won 4-0. The last goal again, that City scoring for the third game in a row with one of their players on the ground appealing for medical attention. This is an incredible run that they're on. De Bruyne first with the Rodri goal, then Zinchenko on the Bernardo Silva goal, and now Sterling on the Fernandinho goal against Leeds. And at the end of this, and with then what happens with Everton and Burnley, who have now taken 10 points from the four matches since they sacked Sean Dyche, in like the most inspired sacking of the season is what it looks like.
Of history, surely.
Well, everyone, you know, whichever one of these teams goes down, they've all sacked a manager. You know, they've all sacked a kind of a big name manager. In the context of the club, you know, in that Rafa Benitez is a Champions League winning manager, with a lot of experience, and his replacement is much less experienced. BL says, you know, a legendary coach, and Jesse Marsh is kind of like an American, you know, who's still learning his trade. And then you've got Dyche, who was Burnley. He literally was Burnley. And then he's been replaced by a guy called Michael Jackson, who, you know, I mean, this guy isn't Burnley, you know? So in each case, you've had a big decision made. And one of these is going to look like a really wrong decision. And the other two are going to look right, just by the mathematics of this situation. But Leeds are now the favourites to go down. They have to play Chelsea, Arsenal, Brentford and Brighton, none of which at this point looks like an easy game for them. I mean, Chelsea, the way they played against Everton, is going to be an easy game. But Chelsea now have to respond to that. Arsenal, you know, are chasing the Champions League, you know, and again, they were too good for Declan Rice's West Ham. Actually, can we get to Declan Rice?
We can. Again, we even have some audio of Declan Rice. Do you want to finish your point on Leeds, or
it's a difficult situation that they're in now. I mean, Burnley are in such a weird situation where they have to play Aston Villa twice in their last four matches. Now, if you're to pick a team in the league that you'd like to play twice in your last four matches, it might actually be Aston Villa. You know what I mean? You're kind of thinking, well,
Wolves didn't look super into it this weekend. I have to say.
No, they didn't.
The beach looms large in the Wolves' consciousness right now.
Yeah, and you know how did Southampton get on this weekend? Did they lose to Palace?
To Crystal Palace. Yeah,
yeah. You know,
I'm going to say there are a couple of clubs there that I mean Brighton too. Let's be honest.
Yeah,
Brighton and even Brentford. Brighton and Brentford are two not bad games to have in your last four games.
Yeah, Brighton have only lost one of their last six, I think, you know what I mean? And that was against Man City, and they've beaten Arsenal, they've beaten Tottenham. You know, they obviously beat Wolves yesterday. And Brentford are on their best run of the season. You know, they've got 10 points for the last four matches. You know, maybe the job is done now. But, you know, they're
satisfied.
Brentford are in a good moment. They
could need another bite, Ken.
They're
absolutely bloody stuffed.
You get money for points and all this kind of stuff, and I kind of feel like Thomas Frank is always going to have an eye on those points totals because that's his legacy. You know what I mean? And I don't think he's going to be. I don't think he's going to be saying, "Well, we're in the Premier League. What does it matter if it's 10th or 17th?" I think for someone like Thomas Frank, that makes a very big difference. So
what about Ricey anyway?
Ricey, well, I mean, what a weekend it's been for Ricey. I mean, first of all, a disappointing sort of start to the weekend with the Thursday night defeat to Eintracht Frankfurt, which, you know, in front of a huge home crowd, which obviously was disappointing. But then to finish third in the Football Writers Award poll, which also was disappointing, you know, to finish behind Mo Salah and Kevin De Bruyne, as he did, is disappointing. You know, when you're an English captain of West Ham, you know, it's and you can only finish third in the Football Writers Award. I think you need to.
I mean, Noble won it like three or four times, didn't he?
No, he didn't. Mark Noble hasn't won it, to be fair. but Rice, I mean, did you not think that was sort of remarkable? Third in the Football Writers. What? Why is Rice finishing third in this award?
I mean, exceptional play by an Englishman in the Premier League. Exceptional in English footballing by a English player in the English Premier League.
Yeah, I just don't really see, what makes him, quite so outstanding.
Well, I think I just said it four times in the last sentence I said there. His Englishness. He's as English as they come.
Declan Rice.
Yeah. And
don't you forget it.
I mean, yeah. I just think of guys like, I mean, there are obviously a bunch of players that you could say just from Liverpool and City, you know, who have been way better than him. But, you know, there's also like Son or, you know, I don't know.
I mean, so many players that one name can't spring to mind for you.
Well, there could be
12 City players, like 10 Liverpool players.
I felt it was
Bruno Fernandes. I thought had a great season. No, I'm just kidding.
I did see Declan Rice on TV doing a little interview with Patrick Davison, and where one of those where. Just to mix up the interview format a little bit, let's show him some pictures and you get him to talk about the pictures. You know, one of the pictures, well, I mean, he'll say himself what it was a picture of.
England debut, Czech Republic. I could handle it. It was just more the fact my first time you're being watched by a nation, you know, it's like pressure. But now I live for that. And then to obviously start so well against Italy, thinking that we're going to do it, to then having the heartbreak, it's horrible. I hate other people winning, hate other people having an edge over you, and to see them lift the trophy on your patch, it's not what you want, really.
Yeah, it was very sad to lose to Italy in that way. A team that couldn't even qualify for the World Cup, as it turned out. But mastered Wembley that night. It was sad. But, you know, I have to admit, Kieran, that I was triggered by this.
What makes you think that anger is a useful response? It's just an idiotic response.
I was a little bit because, you know, just the way that he talks about it, and he's, you know, I'm not saying that there's no non-triggering way Declan Rice can speak about his England debut. I'm just saying that, like, he should, you know, he
maybe
said
just
so,
stop talking about his England debut.
Look, again, I mean, he was asked, what's he supposed to do?
Yeah. Didn't we play a clip from him talking about his England debut like 3 months ago?
Yeah, well, that was Gary Neville talking to him about it, right? Well, in fairness, didn't Gary Neville ask him, what's the most special moment? And that was the thing he thought of.
England debut.
But in this case, he says, it's the first time, a nation watching you, the pressure. And I'm kind of like, actually, you were more experienced than almost every other international player in this exact thing of how does it feel? How does it feel to make your international debut?
You only have one international debut is what 99% of players around the world can say. But Declan Rice is part of that very special 0.01%, in fact, where he can say, well, actually, sometimes it felt so good you could do it twice.
But they were they were like, oh, he's great, and look at these stats and so on. And, he's got a lot of passes and a lot of touches. You notice that he doesn't really pass the ball forward much. Actually, there was an example of it in this game where he helped to make the West Ham goal happen with a nice crossfield pass to Soufal, who set up Jared Bowen with the cross for what was West Ham's equaliser at that point. But he's a player who likes to run forward with the ball at his feet.
Mm. He's got very good posture as well, you'd have to say. I think that impresses a lot of football writers,
Yeah.
He's got that erect bearing.
He does. He really
looks
does.
Like a leader, Ken. You can come at me with stats and everything, but there are certain, indefinable things that lift a Declan Rice above, say, a Bernardo Silva or a Sadio Mane, for instance, And that is, just you stick your chest out, That chest may or may not have three lines on it, of course. That's neither here nor there. Yeah. But you stick your chest out. If the three lines are there, then that will help people see it all the more clearly.
Yeah.
You stick your chest out, you straighten the back, and you lead. There are sheep, and then there are leaders. And Declan Rice is a leader.
Night out.
He is a leader. But, sometimes I wonder if he could move the ball a bit faster. That's why that's my kind of query with him. He's looking good in a lot of ways. He's really high in sort of interceptions and stuff like this. He's not much of a presser in the West Ham structure, but that's maybe because of the slightly more reactive focus that West Ham have when they're defending than some of the other teams. I don't doubt that Declan Rice has the physical capacity to do a lot of pressing if he was in a team that required him to do that. But it's just the sort of, can he actually pass the ball forward, which I would question a little bit. I mean, Jermaine Defoe, I saw say, he reminds me of Michael Carrick a bit. And I thought, does he? He doesn't remind me of Michael Carrick. I mean, Michael Carrick was a really silky player who kind of took a while to develop the athletic side of his game to the point where he was like, he got away with it. Whereas Rice is a super athletic player who, to my mind, doesn't have any of Carrick's, he doesn't have Carrick's like kind of know-how when it comes to passing the football. To me, they're quite different. Anyway, Declan Rice has lost four of his last six now at the business end of the season. So a lot of food for thought there for West Ham's captain. I do have to say, I think they were a little bit unlucky in this Arsenal game, though, because there was a moment when the bantering Ramsdale sallied forth from his area.
His winning smile was nearly wiped off his face, Ken, I would say.
Well, it was crazy what happened, because first of all, Ramsdale, the ball was played through. Jared Bowen is now chasing it. And you can see Ramsdale, who is positioned just outside his box. He's not like really pushed very high. He slightly hesitates, and then he's like, no, I've got to go for this, right? But that moment, that little moment of hesitation has actually cost him his chance of winning this ball. But now he's fully committed, and he's going for the ball. And really, it's all on the lap of the gods now, and also Jared Bowen. If he wants to do something about this, at least he can see Ramsdale coming from a long way off. And Ramsdale comes through like an express train, studs up, like actually already sort of waving his little hands and, I'm sorry, I didn't mean this. Sorry, I didn't mean this gesture. As he plows directly across the line of Bowen's run, Bowen jumps into the air and goes flying, spills to the ground, and is booked for diving, which I thought was the craziest decision. This has got to be a foul the other direction for Ramsdale. Mm. Because even if there's an argument that Bowen at this point finds it convenient to go to ground because maybe his touch that he's taken is too heavy and the ball's going to go out of play for a throw before he gets there. Maybe that's what he's worried about. The only reason he's had to take such a bad touch is because there's this enormous guy like about to kill him.
Already, you know, apologising for the horror tackle.
Oh, Jesus Christ, I really hope he's able to get out of the way of this one, is what Ramsdale said. Then he gets away with it. Like, I thought that was amazing. Like, the ref is almost saying to him, your choice is broken leg or yellow card. You know, what do you want? Okay, you'll take the booking? Okay, fair enough. But I did think that was very, you know, and we've talked about this particular situation as well as one as increasingly the one where most of the most dangerous incidents happen on the field between a goalkeeper who's rushing out, which is a fairly new situation. I mean, it's not like it's the only time this has ever happened, but it's not, you know, keepers used to stay on their line a bit more and now they're encouraged to come running out to clear these. So you're getting situations in nearly every game, but the goalkeepers are acting as though they can just go into it with like full force and kind of almost impunity. And decisions like that, I think, just encourage that, which is a dangerous habit and one that will lead, I think, to serious injuries.
I've lived here 20 years and none of my friends wanted England to win last night. You can't even enjoy a football match without it being 800 years of oppression. Of course we don't want England to win. It's awful.
Good afternoon. England came and played Ireland in Croke Park in rugby. We did not boo their national anthem.
My grandfather was in Croke Park in 1920 when black and tans invaded, and he ran for his life.
That's the type of arrogance that unfortunately makes Irish people not want to support the English team.
My own grandfather in Dublin was shot by the black and tans in both knees.
We have one thing in common. You gave us your language because you took ours away from us.
My husband Paddy, his grandparents were burnt out of their business and home in Belfast just because they were Catholics. Well, you didn't go on keep harping on it.
The reason why we don't support England, why would we support England?
Oh, God.
Yeah, but tell me why I would want to support England.
Are you asking me?
Yes. Why you would expect an Irish person to support England.
They revere Jack Charlton.
Why would I want to support English football?
Harry Kane's got grandparents from Galway. Declan Rice is Irish descent. Jack Grealish is Irish descent. What more does he want?
Tell me one reason we would support them. They brought us everything from the Great Hunger to Bloody Sunday. They still occupy part of my country. So why would I want to support them?
You know, the construction firms, like, they got all chances. I mean, if they was English people were like, so anti-Irish, they wouldn't have been given the chance.
I'm Irish. Why would I want to support an English team?
Why would you support Italy over England? You know, you're not Italian, but you'll support Italy. Why would you support Italy then?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't go out of my way to support Italy, other than the Italians are in the fish and chip shops here that I know locally, and I would give them encouragement.
And I like fish and chips, and the players like the fish and chips.
Jacob Steinberg, it's great to talk to you on the podcast today.
Hi.
I am wondering what you can tell us about the Chelsea ownership situation. How close are we to getting a final outcome?
Well, we've been waiting and waiting and waiting, and it's felt close for quite a few weeks, and there's been the possibility of, you know, hearing something from Rain, that the bank were handling everything over in New York, and, you know, you've been hearing this is going to be the week, this is going to be the week, and then it's dragged on, and it seemed like nothing's going to happen, and now it does seem like we're finally approaching some kind of conclusion, assuming that there are no hitches and nothing goes wrong, that it does look like it will be Todd Bowley's consortium who on Friday, without any official confirmation from the club or from Rain or even from Todd Bowley's camp, that that consortium has been picked as the preferred bidder over the other bids that were in the race for it. So it would seem that in the next couple of weeks, possibly, that Chelsea could have new owners. It's not, again, there's no actual time frame on how quickly this could all progress. They're into a exclusivity processed now, the Bowley camp, and I think they've got, you know, maybe five days or so to conclude those talks, and then it should be theirs. And you would hope that during that time nothing goes wrong. Obviously, they made themselves, you know, they were quite proactive when this all got going. Obviously, everything kind of kicked off when the Swiss billionaire Hans Jörg Weiss basically announced in the Swiss newspaper Blick that Abramovich wanted to sell and that he was looking to put it together. And then it came out quite quickly that he was working with Todd Bowley, who previously tried to buy Chelsea in 2019. And obviously after that, the sanctions came and other groups came in, and there were a lot of interesting parties to sift through for Rain and Chelsea. But it has always felt like the Bowley group is the one that has, you know, for a start, has been there in the past and also presented the least complications given some of the issues that were presented by the other bidders. So hopefully it will be soon, and Chelsea can start thinking about the future, because obviously I think we're seeing on the pitch this is probably starting to have a bit of an effect now.
What sort of complications do you mean? What complications were presented by other bidders that weren't presented by Bowley's consortium?
Well, in terms of the ones that passed through that initial the initial phase from Rain, which was at the end of March, where they picked a few bidders to go through to the next stage, and that was going to be three bidders. It ended up being four. So obviously the most problematic bid, from the perspective of a lot of supporters at least, was the Ricketts family, and that was due to the allegations of Islamophobia. From historic emails from the father of Tom Ricketts, and those were emails that surfaced that were written quite a long time ago and surfaced a couple of years ago, and when the Ricketts were put forward as bidders, Chelsea fans found this and it all kind of kicked off, especially on social media, and there was a huge campaign against the Ricketts family, and in the end it felt for a while like they seemed to have some kind of momentum behind them, despite the fan opposition, and that there was a bit of a relationship between Tom Ricketts and Rain from past business dealings. And it felt like, hang on, is it going to be them regardless? And then just before we were about to get the absolute final bids through, then suddenly out of nowhere, the Ricketts family absolutely just withdrew their offer because they couldn't get agreement between, they said, the parties that are involved in their consortium as to the nature of it and how they would structure everything, which just sort of added a bit more of a shambolic air to what was already feeling like quite a confusing process. They always said that it had nothing to do with the fact that the fans were totally against them. And in terms of the other ones, you had the bid put together by Sir Martin Broughton, who wasn't the money behind this. And one of the issues with that bid was that it was never entirely clear all the way through where that money was coming from. There was a certain lack of transparency. And one of the big issues was that a lot of the money was coming from Josh Harrison and David Blitzer, the Americans who have that big stake in Crystal Palace, which obviously they would have needed to get rid of and may well not have worked for Chelsea in a time frame, despite their insistence that getting rid of those shares or divesting them would have been a relatively quick process for Chelsea. This license they've been granted by the government runs out on the 31st of May. And beyond that, you can see the effect that it's having on Thomas Tuchel and his players on the pitch. So they need something that is not going to potentially cause issues with the Premier League or anything like that. And the other one was Steve Pagliuca, who, the owner of the Boston Celtics, seems like a very knowledgeable, very successful guy, probably would have been a good owner, but again, has shares at stake in Atalanta, who would be competing in the same competition as Chelsea. Again, impossible. So how do you get past that? The Bowley consortium doesn't have any of those kind of issues in terms of people owning parts of other football clubs. There were no obvious political problems that the Ricketts family would have presented. So you're hoping that this one isn't going to run into those kind of issues off the field and start dragging Chelsea into places they don't want to be. Mm-hmm. And just that, the one sticking point probably at the moment is that Sir Jim Ratcliffe, the richest man in Britain and or currently lives in Monaco anyway, put in this shocked like offer as on Friday.
This is what I was wondering about. It's this when I saw this news, I kind of assumed, Jacob, that Jim Ratcliffe would be successful because I thought, well, first of all, it's being reported here, although I suppose who knows, that this is actually the biggest bid financially. He's offering more money than the others. Secondly, there's only one of him. Whereas if I look at this, you know, even this Bowley consortium, you know, there's Bowley, there's Vice, there's other people involved, names I've seen, Jonathan Goldstein, Mark Walter, Daniel Finkelstein, George Osborne. You know, some of these people are more central, more important. Some of them are just there for, I guess, name value. But there's a lot of people involved. You know what I mean? Whereas surely it would be better if it was just one guy.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose on the, for example, with the Bowley one, Jonathan Goldstein and Todd Bowley have worked together before and know each other. So it's not a partnership that's come out of the blue. On the on the issue of Jim Ratcliffe, I'd heard during at some point in March that he may well have been someone who was putting together a bid, and that was very strongly denied by his spokesperson, and it was pretty much battered away, and it seemed like he just had no interest. It's interesting if you go back I think to 2018 or 2019, he did an interview with Matt Dickinson, who's the Times journalist who broke the story on Friday, and he was talking about how there was no value in Premier League clubs and how he'd never be, I think he said, the dumb money, and that Premier League clubs, including Chelsea, who he had looked at buying in 2018, were simply too expensive. And obviously we've seen during this process that to buy Chelsea, you're going to need around £3 billion, which is quite a lot of money. So it did come out of the blue, and it was a surprise given what had previously been said. And also the fact that that Ineos, the company that he owns, are the owners of Nice, who have a chance of getting into the Champions League for next season. So again, it would have been an issue, but he obviously has made his offer 2 weeks after the final deadline for offers. And you do wonder, it's unclear as why he waited so long, and it's unclear why he thought that would be successful. And yet there's also just that sense of, could it present any kind of complication to it? Probably not, but with this process, you just wouldn't want to say anything with 100% certainty.
It is very strange, just the idea of sort of saying you're not really interested and then coming in with a big offer, apparently when it's too late. You know, if it sort of goes to Bowley anyway, you do wonder what Ratcliffe was doing here, because it looks a little bit unserious, you know, what he's done. But just on the point that he raised to Matt Dickinson, you know, there's no value in Premier League clubs. This is what he was saying. Or maybe that wasn't actually his real view. If he was prepared to bid, you know, £4 billion for one, but you know, I mean, I see it reported that the Bowley consortium's total bid is in excess of £4 billion. Now that's not all for the club. £1.5 billion to develop the club and Stamford Bridge. And £2.5 billion is Rain's valuation of Chelsea. That is massive money. I mean, that's far more than for any sports institution, I guess. I think the record, wasn't it, some NFL team? I can't remember the exact record. But, you know, it's the record for a sports team is like more around the sort of $2 billion mark. And this is like, this absolutely blows that away. Where is the value in this? Do you think, what is the motivation for paying so much money for Chelsea? I mean, clearly they think they think it's going to be worth more in a few years. I mean, I guess we can make that assumption about them. But how do you think? What do you think is the thought process that's led to that conclusion?
Well, it's interesting you say that they think it will be worth more, because Joe Ravitch, who's the founder of, I think he was the founder of Rain, he's certainly someone who certainly very senior there. I think I'm right in saying that he's the founder. He was in it. I think he did an interview with Reuters last week and said that in a few years, these American owners, potential American owners of Premier League clubs, they'll be able to sell these clubs for about $10 billion. So the view from someone who has more of a financial insight than I do is that these clubs are simply going to get more and more valuable. And you certainly, you know, when you, as you say, when you look at Chelsea going for something, the ultimate figure being something like 4 billion, given all the investment that has to go into it, you would wonder what a club like Manchester United would go for should the Glazers ever decide that they've had enough of it. I think that partly it's seen as from the American perspective, I think it's owning a Premier League club is, it's probably not going to make you loads of money, but it would be seen to be, you know, something that a must have accessory almost. There are now so many American owners in the Premier League, some good, some, you know, certainly Liverpool will be the one that spring to mind and would be the model that I would hope Chelsea go for, and some not so great. But it's the richest league in the world, isn't it? And it continues to make all kinds of money, and it's blowing other leagues out of the water. Everybody just wants to watch the Premier League, so it may well be because of that, and that's where the value comes into it. I think for Chelsea though, it's difficult to know exactly where they go from here, because obviously they've had the ultimate benefactor in Roman Abramovich, and they've been able to exist while with an owner who was willing anyway. We'll see whether this is going to be possible to write off a £1.5 billion loan. And we'll have to see whether or not, under the terms of his sanctions, whether that is actually even possible.
Just on that question, Jack, first of all, I'd just like to clear up the record price that's been paid for a sports team, a sports franchise, is $2.4 billion for the New York Mets in 2020. The NFL record is $2.27 billion for the Carolina Panthers. That was 2018. The Denver Broncos are going on sale at the moment and are expected to go for maybe set a new record, but I don't know if it would be up there in terms of £4 billion for Chelsea. What relevance does Roman Abramovich have to all this is the last question, because, you know, he was obviously sanctioned in a blaze of publicity, the club was frozen and so on and so forth, and yet he seems to have been kind of having input into this process. You know, at one point there was a report, well, Abramovich has asked for an extra £500 million, he doesn't think this is enough. What does he have to do with it? Is he not out of the picture due to the sanctions? If this sale goes through, where does the money go? What is the relationship with the former owner here? Is that clear yet?
Well, in terms of where the money goes, that's something that will have to be cleared up in as and when the sale goes through, because I think at the moment nobody has any real clarity on that. Does it go into some kind of holding account and it just stays there? Does it go to the government? I'm thinking out loud. It's impossible to say, because the only real thing that the government seems to care about is that not a penny goes to Abramovich. And I think there were certain groups who were hopeful that the government would maybe take more of a view on who should be the owners, and when that actually wasn't the case, because I don't think the government has bigger things to think about ultimately than who owns Chelsea. And once that wasn't the case, I think certain groups were probably their chances of owning the club were much lower. So it's still Abramovich's club. It's still, you know, the people who are who've been holding talks with all those bidders last week, because they were all at Stamford Bridge for final pitches last week, apart from obviously Sir Jim Ratcliffe, who did still talk to Bruce Buck. But the people who are doing this on behalf of Abramovich are obviously just his people. So it's Marina Granovskaya and it's Bruce Buck and those kind of people who have, Bruce Buck has known Abramovich for years. Marina Granovskaya has worked for him for 25 years, hasn't she? So he is very much involved in it. And I don't think that, despite everything that's gone on, I don't think that anybody would really doubt that Abramovich did have a huge affection for Chelsea and did want them to do well.
At the same time, though, Jacob, the higher the price that's paid for the club, the less money whoever it is who has bought the club has to actually invest in the club. I mean, you know, usually these things are pretty simple to understand. I mean, the price
it's going to go to the former owner. That's that, you know, that's what everyone understands, that's everyone understands, that's who receives the payment. In this case, it's sort of like, we need you to jack up the payment, but we don't know who's going to get the payment. But we do know that, like, once you've put the money in that box, it won't actually be available for Chelsea anymore. You'll still be paying your interest, or, you know, however you manage to finance this enormous payment to whoever. It's just a very unusual situation.
Yeah, it is bizarre. And obviously that story last week that came from initially from Mark Kleinman, who's been Sky News, has been great on this, about Abramovich asking them to raise the price by 500 million. But then it kind of became unclear, is that actually the price that he wants them to pay to himself or for the club, sorry, or was it something to go into this charity pot for victims of the war in Ukraine? And again, there was another murky element of all of this, because was it money for Ukrainian victims or was it money for...
It was money for all the victims, very, very
clearly
stated.
Which obviously raises the prospect of it going to Russians, and that was another part of it. And there's an element of how exactly you interpret the PR behind all of this. And I mean, obviously there are elements of it, though, where he's asked for some of that investment simply to be in part of the infrastructure of the club. So you're not paying just ultimately 4 billion to buy Chelsea. Part of that is, will you pay £1 billion? You know, will you commit over the next however many years to invest in the academy, to invest in the women's team, in the men's team? And part of that as well is going to be for Chelsea, which is a huge problem and something that really will hold them back without Abramovich and will be something that the new owner is going to have to sort out, is what you do with Stamford Bridge, because it's a smaller ground, it's pretty old, and it doesn't have necessarily the same, you can't make the same kind of money from match day. It's probably not got the same kind of commercial potential as probably Spurs and Arsenal with their new grounds. And it's something that the new owners are going to have to work out, and it's going to be very difficult because of where it is. It's next to a tube line, which makes it tricky. You've got the whole issue with the Chelsea pitch owners, so you're going to find it very difficult to move to another site, which is something that Abramovich had explored. So that's part of it, is going to be that investment is going to go into those parts of the, you would hope anyway, for the sake of the club, that it's going to go into protecting the infrastructure and ensuring that it can remain competitive. But all of this is just totally uncertain, because it's going to be completely different without somebody who was just able to, in one summer, without really thinking about it, dump £200 million on quite a lot of players who haven't worked out. And then just, you know, under Abramovich, it would have been the case that you would have just kind of forgotten about it and just absorbed the loss. And that's not going to be the way it's going to work, I think, with an American ownership.
Okay, Jacob Steinberg, thanks very much for coming on and explaining all that to us today.
Great, thanks.
I'll ask Gary if he thinks, like, the publicity he's given young Frank there warrants it, because personally I don't think he's quite a good number. No, I also think that in the last couple of years you've let some good midfielders go for peanuts, like Matt Holland and Scott Cannon.
Well, no, they definitely wasn't good enough. I tell you now, you know, you can sit in front of all these people, I tell you, without any shadow of a doubt, there will be no comparison with what Frank Lampard will achieve in football and what Scotty Cannon will achieve in football. And I may be now, I didn't want to say this in front of him, but he will go right to the very top. Right to the very top.
Well, there you are. You heard it here first.
He has given them belief. It's almost the perfect man management.
I love this club. When we start the season, wanting to win.
I'm convinced Frank Lampard will become England manager.
Frank Lampard's lost 8 games.
Well, I can't drag people out of the medical room.
But for some reason, hey, Frank's doing all right. Frank, maybe because he's English. I don't know.
Why do you think you were off the pace today?
I know, that's one for the players.
I'd love Frank Lampard to get the Chelsea job in 10 years' time.
Frank's track record on CV, went to Derby, didn't get promoted. But Frank's got all the answers for Chelsea. He hasn't.
I think for a journalist to be objective would be a big start.
Harry Redknapp joins us live this morning. Harry, good morning to you.
Good morning. People need time. You lose 4 or 5 games, it doesn't suddenly make you a bad manager. You're only as good as your players at the end of the day, and the players that are brought in, the two German players, have been massive disappointments.
Yeah.
massive. I've not yet seen a manager that can turn very average players into great players. I'm still looking to see somebody who can do that.
Oh, there you are. You heard it here first.
And I tell you now, there ain't no doubt about that, in my opinion.
Okay, Tom Pod Creela Bjogna Creekna Anish, Tommy on Vrodul Ve in a he in och own Marskano, ah, Tom Fairmore Larger, Rasharish Amorik, Lacoon of Jay. It's been a Baltana Festival of Sport on today's show. That will continue this week as we'll be talking about Katie, wonderful, amazing, era defining Katie, the Hannigan Cup quarterfinals, the Champions League semi finals. We barely even have time to talk about Brian Cody and Henry Shefflin's handshake.
What happened with that handshake? I was looking at it, I was like, I don't get what's going on here.
Well, what do you make of it? You don't know. You're eager to find out.
Well, what I made of it was, I mean, not knowing the recent history of what's been going on between these two guys, who I know they soldiered together. Mm. What it seemed to me is that Brian Cody was holding onto his hand for way too long.
Well, the clip that you saw, Ken, because you were watching the Sunday game, the same as myself, of course, last night, as you always do, that was slowed down a lot. I think, right?
Okay.
You could read a lot into the, like, I certainly thought Cody was the one trying to send a message. Like, all Shefflin wanted to do was shake his hand and get out of there. Cody was trying to send a message to Shefflin there. Now, some would say the message that he was sending was, you're a Kilkenny man managing a team against Kilkenny, therefore you are a traitor. That is one message that he could have been sending. The message I actually think he was sending was that you just got a really lucky free to win this game. And I'm going to mention it. Actually, wait. No, I'm not going to mention it. And then he just held onto his hand a bit and then left.
Right.
So I think that's my opinion. And now others may think differently. But certainly I think that's the message that Cody was sending, as opposed to anything deeper about the, a reasonably fractured relationship by the end of Shefflin's career. Certainly the last season of Shefflin's career was not the happiest one in the Brian Cody-Henry Shefflin relationship. I don't know. It was pretty interesting, though. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Mm. Lots more of Ken's hurling hot takes to come this week, of course. But there was one other thing you wanted to mention, the death of Mina Raiola, who, is a fairly gigantic figure in world football over the last 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, and, obviously Mina Raiola's death was prematurely reported last week, and he kind of had one last zinger saying, no, I'm pretty pissed off, but I'm not gone yet. Well, unfortunately, he is now dead at the age of only 54, which is very sad. This was a guy who, he had sort of emerged as the most successful agent of the last 10 or 15 years, I mean, with a particular attitude. I think it's interesting to look at this testimonial put up by Matthijs de Ligt, who was one of his clients. Dear Mino, I'm not ready to write this message. I think I never will be. It's too early for us players, for your family, but especially for you. You had so many dreams to fulfill, so many things left to do. I thought you were crazy when you told me about the things you were planning, but you were always right in the end. You knew how the world worked. Nothing is impossible. You showed that to the whole world. The moment I met you for the first time, I knew you were someone special. Completely different to me, but we had one thing in common. We wanted to do our job as good as possible and get everything out of our lives. You fought for your players together with your team. That's why you were so loved by all of them, because as you always said, they're my sons, my family. Now it's time we have to change roles. You did everything for us, and now we have to do everything for the people you love the most, your family. I promise we will take care of everything you loved us together as your sons. Mino, I'll miss you for everything. Like you said, to be the bad guy against everybody for me, to be my agent, but especially to be my best friend, someone who I could always ask for help, who was ready to fight for me, also someone with whom I could talk about life in general, someone who knew so much about certain things that I am angry with myself I didn't ask you more. I'm sure at some point I can ask you more and cuddle you again, because I miss you already way too much. I love you, Mino. Love, heart. So that's from Matthijs de Ligt, Juventus central defender, to his dearly departed agent, Mino Raiola. He is a guy who, you can see from that the effect that he had on his clients. I don't think it's going too far to say that they loved him, Mm. He managed to have this effect on
young players, like, you know, Zlatan Ibrahimovic.
Being the bad guy for me is kind of an interesting line as well. I mean, maybe that's just the role of the agent generally, but that he wasn't afraid to be.
You see in the sort of the technique, like these, his sort of seduction technique with these players. I mean, Zlatan was the one who probably gave the most detailed account of it. But, you know, sort of a case of like, oh, you think you're so great. He started nagging them, you know. You need to be better at this, making them feel a little bit insecure. And then that whole idea of, you know, you need someone to be your bad guy, you know, because the world's full of these and you need someone to do that for you. And I suppose kind of what he offered the players was the sense of, this guy's going to look after me. I can sort of outsource my security concerns to this guy who is going to, deal with all the snakes out there. And he's the biggest and baddest one of them all. You know what I mean? And this is very attractive to a certain kind of player. And it proved to be a very lucrative skill for Mino, who made some of the most gigantic commissions in the history of the sport. I mean, this is why I don't think that his... I think that he was a very talented agent. But when you're making 40 million euros off one sale, which is his reported commission for moving Paul Pogba from Juventus to Manchester United, you're sort of thinking, wow, that really is a lot. There's not many agents who manage to increase their share of the proceeds to such an enormous extent. But, you know, most of his players seem to be pretty happy with it. Whether his players have had great careers, guys like Pogba would say no. Mkhitaryan may be a little disappointing given his talent. De Ligt has not been great so far at Juventus, but, you know, he's obviously still a young player. Balotelli, no. Ibrahimovic, I would say, not bad. Not bad at all. But that sort of, you know, Erling Haaland is the latest. Haaland is going to go to Manchester City now. But, you know, we'll see if the stable of stars continues to behave in the same way in the absence of this singular genius, Mino Raiola.
Who died this weekend. Okay, thanks a million for listening, and we'll chat to you on the World Service tomorrow.
What one is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.